And I'm over here. And if you ever come and visit, be sure to call me beforehand. I'll meet you for lunch or dinner or whatever. So my husband and I have lived here. I've lived here 30 years. My husband was born and raised here. And I run the IONS group in Santa Barbara for the last 9 years, just almost 10 years now. And I love it. And I'm going to talk tonight. I'm going to give a talk that I call The Amazing Life of a Double Dead Redhead. Since I had two near-death experiences. Okay. And I'm going to go ahead and talk about the second one first, because I didn't actually know about the first one until I was a very much older adult in my 50s. Someone's going to mute their microphone, I can tell. So my second one was in 1987, and I had had a pregnancy that was a problem pregnancy, and I was married to someone that was an engineer here in Santa Barbara, and I had not realized before I married him that he had anger issues, control issues, abuse issues. So I was ready to have a baby, and I delivered the baby. We had the little girl. It's a little redhead like myself. And about a month later, I was kind of forced to lift something by my ex-husband, and it caused me to rupture a disc in my back. And so I struggled through finding someone that could help me. Finally found a neurosurgeon, and he wanted to do surgery and actually do a laminectomy, discectomy, and clear out the disc and the parts of it that had spurted out. So he had scheduled a surgery in December of 1987. My daughter was about 5 months old at that time. And he had gotten on board a orthopedic surgeon. So he was a neurosurgeon, orthopedic surgeon was joining him. And they were doing it at a local hospital near my house. And what ended up happening was they called me a few days beforehand and said, I really want you to come into the hospital the day before the surgery, because the surgery was going to be at 7 a.m. And I want to do one final test. The orthopedic surgeon and I want to see if when your disc blew, if parts of it chipped your spinal cord, because you are not able to walk, we think that the spinal cord may be damaged. So they wanted to do what's called a myelogram, and that's where they inject iodine dye into your spinal cord. And in my case, they did it right back at the back of my neck. And they had me laying on an x-ray table, and this was the night before the surgery was happening the next morning. And I had, interestingly, both the doctors were present, as well as a couple of x-ray technicians and a nurse in the room. And they had me on an x-ray table. And they injected the dye in, and they told me you have to hold very still, because if you move at all, you could have headaches for months afterward. So I wanted to avoid that. And they injected the dye in, and one of the x-ray techs was had his finger on the side of the table, and it was supposed to start raising my head up and lowering my feet so that the dye with gravity could run down my spine. And they could then look at the area that the disc had blown out at and see if the spinal cord was damaged in that area. So the table started moving, and I started feeling very funny right off the bat. And I was 31 years old at the time, and I wasn't the type of person who questioned authority, because my mom, when I was growing up, from my teen years on, was a sheriff, and she carried a Smith & Wesson gun in her purse and handcuffs, and she worked for the police department, and I learned never to question authority. So as the table was tipping, I started thinking, you know, should I be feeling like this? I feel like I'm going to faint. But the two x-ray techs were talking to each other unfortunately, about their weekend plans, and I didn't want to interrupt them. And the two doctors were leaning against a wall, kind of maybe 5 feet or so away from the table, waiting for the x-ray tech with the monitor to show them the area that they would be doing the surgery on. So as the table was tipping, it got worse and worse for me. And I knew at one point that I was going to faint. Oh. I thought I was going to faint, not die. I had no idea. And so I wanted to say to the x-ray techs, the two x-ray techs, you know, hey, something's going wrong here. So the minute that I tried to speak, I realized that I actually could think clearly, but I could not open my mouth and I could not say anything and I could not move my arm to reach out and touch them. So I was pretty trapped in my body, knowing that something was going wrong, and I started feeling panicky. And the two x-ray techs weren't noticing. And what ended up happening was that I started hyperventilating right close to the time that I died. And one of the x-ray techs that was pushing the button on the table noticed that I was breathing very fast and and so he stopped talking to the other guy, and he leaned over my face and looked in my eyes, and my eyes were rolling to the back of my head. So I was trying to keep them forward and staying present in the room and not passing out, but I was having a tough time. And when he saw that, he leaned back, and the last thing I saw him do was lean back and look to see where his finger was on the button for the x-ray table and then make this look like, and just like, oh no. And he then, that's when I shut my eyes in my body. And, you know, I wasn't trying to, it just happened. I shut my eyes, and the next second I wasn't in my body. I was above it on the ceiling. It felt like the ceiling was against the back of my head, but as far as I know, I didn't have a body up there, but I felt the barrier of the ceiling, and I was looking straight down at my body, the tops of their heads, the top of the x-ray machine, and that man with his finger on the button started calling code blue. He realized that I had stopped breathing. So immediately, everyone in the room went into action, and the nurse started calling for a defib unit, and she was yelling stat into the phone. And an oxygen cart appeared in the room. The two x-ray techs were doing CPR. One was blowing into my mouth. The other one was doing chest compressions on my chest. And then when the oxygen cart came in, they stopped blowing into my mouth and they just put the oxygen mask on my face. And they were still doing the chest compressions. And the doctors were kind of standing back, supervising everything. And then this man came in with a box, square box, and he went around the table on the side between the wall and the table, and he put the box on a ledge, and he started peeling these white little round things and putting them on my chest. And I was watching from above, and I did not know what he was doing. So I actually ended up saying something. Now, what happened when I first got up there was that I felt immediately non-frantic, completely calm, completely wrapped in the warm blanket of love. I mean, I just literally felt beautiful up there, and I wasn't worried at all. I'd gone from complete panic down below, what was happening to me, you know, why can't I talk and why can't I move, to complete beauty. And up on the ceiling, when I initially looked down, I said to myself, I guess, I said, if I'm up here and he's calling code blue down there, I think I just died. And there was no, you know, scared, no nothing, no frantic. And right after I said that, I felt the presence of someone next to me. And that presence to me in my life felt as though it was God, and it felt very much like I had always had him next to me, and I felt very calm and very attached to him. And I began saying to him as I was watching what they were doing down below, the CPR and the oxygen cart rolling in and the woman on the phone screaming for the defib unit and the two doctors standing back and the x-ray techs, I said to him, I really need to go back. If I leave my life in this way at this time and I leave my children in the situation they would be in, because I had a son from a previous marriage that was very short, and I had a beloved eight-year-old son. So I had my little five-month-old daughter and my eight-year-old son. And I knew that the situation would be traumatic for them, for me to leave, because of my protection over them in the situation that I was living in with my husband. And so I spoke to God and said what I felt was God and said, I really need to go back. I need to be in their lives. I need to protect them. I need to be able to help raise them and bring them up so that they will be good human beings. So down below, that man was putting those little white things on my chest. And as I was talking to God, I didn't know what this man was doing. And I kind of stopped in my conversation and saying that I wanted to go back. And I said, what is that he's doing? And the second that I said that, I was moved. My perception of where I was instantly moved to right in front of the box that he had brought into the room. It had a glass window on the front of it that looked dark green and some dials and things on the front of it. And he was putting those white things on my chest. And I did not realize it was a heart monitor that he was connecting up to me. And so when his hand went in front of my face and I watched it as he reached over and he tipped a toggle switch on the side of the box and it turned the green light on in the screen that was across the front of the box. And the green light was flatlining. And I had heard that term, but I had never, I wasn't a TV watcher. So I really didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what I didn't know what a heart monitor looked like. And so I was still very like, what is this? Why is that? What is that little green light going across the screen like that? And why is it making the monotone sound? And so it went across the screen twice and traveled all the way across and then started again, traveled across. And on the third time, about a third of the way over, all of a sudden I understood what it was. And I said, oh, that's my heart. It's not beating. And when I said that, I was automatically moved back up to the ceiling right next to the being again. It was as if he put me down there so that I could, understand what that box was because I had asked about it. And then when I got it, I was moved back up on the ceiling again. So I, again, talked with him in different ways and said how much I needed to be there for my children. Needed to go back into my life. And at this point, the doctors, the neurosurgeon was leaning, kind of behind the guy who had his finger on the button of the x-ray machine and the table. And the neurosurgeon, I heard him say to the orthopedic surgeon, too much time has passed. We're going to lose her. She's going to be brain dead. We need to do something. And so the orthopedic surgeon said, stand clear. And when he said that, the two guys that were at the front of the table, the x-ray techs, they stepped back and no one was in his way. And he took his fist from behind his back, arced it over his head and struck my chest, right? Right where your heart, where they it's called a precordial thump. I'd never heard of that. I'd never seen it. I didn't know anything about it. And when he struck me, it didn't hurt because I was up on the ceiling. So I watched my body respond to the blow and it kind of shook with the blow of his fist. And up on the ceiling, the being spoke to me. And in this beautifully calm voice, he said, but if you go back, you'll still be in your marriage. What will you do? And then he showed me all of these film clips that were just fast little pieces of incidents that had happened in the 7 years that I'd been married to my husband. And they were damaging incidents that were scary. And it was to remind me, I'd been trying to forgive him. I'd been trying to help him change. I'd done everything from, you know, beg him in a long letter to not hit me or the children again. I had left him for a year, and he had promised me that he had gone to counseling and that he had fixed the problem. And my parents, my mom mostly, and he encouraged me to move back in with him. And once I did, you know, it just was a matter of time before he lost his temper again and did the same type of things. So I saw all of those things that had happened, all those incidents, flash, just flash, 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 and it reminded me of everything. And then I was given all the time that I needed to evaluate all of the things that I had done to try to change him. And I thought through that, and I thought through all of the things that I had said. And, you know, it was very amazing because it seemed like, you know, 10 minutes or even longer worth of time that I evaluated everything to that point and finally realized that he wasn't capable of changing, that I had given him every opportunity to do so. And when I had taken him to a marriage family therapist, he had stopped after 3 sessions. I took him to a pastor of our church. He stopped after 2 or 3 sessions. He wasn't interested in changing, and he was just always say that he would. So I then said to the being, if you let me go back into my life, I promise you that I will get strong enough to leave him. And the second I said the word him, the doctor did the second precordial thump, and it was probably only seconds later after the first one. But up on the ceiling, it seemed like time had really spread out. I really felt like I was up there at least a half an hour. And so the second precordial thump restarted my heart. And what I experienced was just shutting my eyes up on the ceiling and opening my eyes. And I was back in my body looking up at everyone with the oxygen mask on my face. So I spoke into the oxygen mask, not knowing what had just happened. I'd never heard of a near-death experience. I had never investigated anything like that. I wasn't into meditation. I, you know, simply was a mom who worked full time, and I, you know, did everything with my kids, all the support stuff with my kids. And so I had no idea that anything like this could exist. And so I spoke into my oxygen mask and said, "What just happened?" And the nurse leaned over me and said, "Stop, don't talk. We need to stabilize you." So for 20 minutes, they did whatever it was that they needed to do to stabilize me. And then finally, everyone in there was waiting to see what I was going to say when they took the oxygen mask off. And when they did, I said, "What just happened? I was up on the ceiling and I could see and hear everything you were doing down here." And the orthopedic surgeon didn't say anything to me. He just was standing next to the table. But the neurosurgeon, he went, "Oh, brother," really sarcastically. So that at 31 years old, I knew what I had just been through. I didn't know what it was called. I didn't know anyone else had ever had it, but I knew exactly what I had just been through. I had never done drugs. I never, ever did drugs. I think I had tried alcohol a couple of times by that time when I was younger. But I chose not to drink alcohol. I didn't want it in my life. I saw what other people had, it happened, what it did to other people's lives. And I said, "No, I'm not going to go down that path." And so I had never been hallucinatory. I had, by that time, I had had a secret clearance with the Department of Defense because I had worked at Hughes Aircraft here in Santa Barbara. And I worked on secret documents in the configuration and data management area. And they checked my background. So, my gosh, they even went back and, you know, clear back to people I knew in high school and relatives of mine and interviewed. And I had a completely clean background. Of course, my mom helped with that one, with making me have the fear of mom. So I had never had anything that would have been, you know, prior to this event, anything weird or anything. So I said, you know, look, I'm telling you the truth. I was up on the ceiling and I could see and hear everything. And then I completely recounted what everyone, not everything, but what everyone had been doing in the room. She was on the phone calling for the defib unit. That man brought in the heart monitor. That, you know, that woman was bringing in the oxygen cart. You know, you said this, you said that. So I completely related everything. And that just shocked the heck out of the whole group. And the neurosurgeon reacted by clenching his fists while I was talking, and he kind of pulled them close to his body, and he was just getting madder and madder, and he was gritting his teeth. And then he went, I am not going to stand here and listen to this. And he stormed out of the room. So everybody else stayed, and the orthopedic surgeon was very nice. And he held my hand and said, what else did you see? What else did you hear? And everyone listened. But when they loaded me onto a gurney and sent me up to my room waiting for the surgery the next day, not a single person that entered my room to check my vitals or, you know, do anything for me that evening or for the next 4 days after the surgery, no one would talk to me about it. I know that it was because of the liability that the hospital had, but it was very isolating for me, and I didn't know what it was called or if anyone had ever had one and why, you know, what happened, what was this, and no one would talk to me. So when my ex-husband came in the next day after the surgery, I was in recovery and he was allowed to come in to see me. I told him what had happened the night before, and he looked at me and just in disdain said, that couldn't have happened. You probably hallucinated it. And that pretty much closed the door for me about talking about it again for many years. I think my daughter was around 12 years old when I finally ended up talking to a nurse about it, and her mom was dying, and I felt that the story could maybe help her with what she was facing with her mom's impending death. And she ended up telling me that it was called a near-death experience, and that many people had had them, and that she had witnessed them before, and that it was something I could check out online. And so I immediately, my husband remembers, for like 3 days, I went on the computer and I searched everything. And I ended up finding the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation, which is run by Dr. Jeffrey Long and his wife, Jody. And I've served on their board for a period of time, as I have served on the International Association for Near-Death Studies board as well, since all of this, you know, came out and I assimilated it into my life. And so it was Jeff Long who invited me to an IANS conference in 2009, and it was in San Diego, so it was an easy trip down the coast for me. And that was where I had a very big breakthrough, because I had been reading about other people's near-death experiences, and I knew mine, you know, from every second of it was more real than any other instance in my whole life. And I could actually talk about it and shut my eyes and actually see my body down below me and see where the x-ray machine was and where the desk was in the room and where the people were standing. And, you know, I could actually relive it when I talked about it. So at this conference in 2009, at the IANS conference, the very first night, there was kind of a meet and greet, and I was standing with Jeff Long and Jody Long. I just met them. I had never met them before, and so I was a little shy, and there were people there. I had no idea who they were, and they were obviously researchers and NDEers and people who were interested in the subject. And so this little small group that we were standing with were talking about the after effects that near-death experiencers have and how they had done research on it. And they have, you know, certain things like increased intuition and, you know, lack of fear of death and other items. You can look at that online on IANS.org. And I was identifying with all of the aspects that they were talking about, but the problem that I was having, and I didn't want to voice it to anyone, was that I was identifying with them, those specific aspects long before I had my near-death experience. And that was bothering me because I couldn't figure out why would I have very strong intuition all the way back to my earliest childhood memories. Why would I have that way before I had my near-death experience? And why would I have had a, you know, lack of fear of dying all the way through my, you know, young life and teen years and all the way up to age 31 where I was when I had my near-death experience? And so I was trying to put all that together. And after the group kind of was talking together, they kind of turned to each other, and these people were then just small conversations. And this woman was standing next to me. So I turned to her and I said, I'm not sure if you can answer this, but I am identifying with these aspects that you're calling after effects all the way back to my childhood. And I had my near-death experience when I was 31, so I'm not sure what to think about that. And she said, she took my hands. It was PMH Atwater, who's written a number of books about near-death experiences, a very well-known researcher. She wrote the Big Book of Near-Death Experiences and, you know, many, many books about it. And so she, I didn't know who she was. And she took my hands and she very calmly looked at me and she said, my dear, if you have those after effects and feel identifying with them all the way back to your early childhood, you should talk with your family and see if perhaps you had another instance in your life that could have been a near-death experience that maybe you haven't been told about, or it could have been at birth and you may not realize it. But she said, these are specific to near-death experiences. And if you identify with most of them, then it's most likely you had one at an earlier age. Well, at the time I thought, what? I had a near-death experience, but that doesn't mean I had more than one. And so it was very shocking to me. And so I went to the conference and I was sitting through all of the speakers and I kept on, you know, thinking back to what she said. And I started realizing that my mom, throughout my life, from probably age 6 to 16, there were probably 6 to 8 times where in a quiet moment with me, she had made the comment, I'm really glad that you stayed, Barbie. We really thought we had lost you at one point, but I'm really glad you stayed. I thought she was talking about when she lost me in a Meyer and Frank store, which is like a Kohl's or a Robinson's or a, you know, Macy's. I was hiding in some clothing racks one time, and I thought she was talking about that all those years. I didn't know there was something else. So after the conference, I ended up contacting an older brother, and he's 10 years older than me. And we were going up to Oregon, where I'm from. Anyway, so I invited him to go out to dinner with his wife and his daughter. And my husband and I met them. And before we went into the restaurant, I kind of took him aside and I said, Brad, I had never told him about my near-death experience. I had not told anyone in my family, no one, none of my siblings knew. And I said, I'm doing a health history on myself all the way back to my birth. And so I'm looking at when I had my vaccinations and when I had injuries, and I'm putting it all together in a full story. So, and in case anything happens in the future, the doctor will have all the information on me. And I said, is there anything, I remember when this happened, that happened, and this happened. Do you remember anything else that I should probably put in that health history on myself? Could you recall anything? And he kind of looked at me and said, not off the top of my head, but let me think about it a little bit. And so we were having dinner and enjoying, and we were all chatting and talking and catching up with each other. And after the dinner, we were outside the restaurant again, and we were kind of, you know, closing down and saying goodbye. And he took my, put his hand on my wrist, and he said, Barbie, there is something I need to tell you. I realized that a lot of times throughout your life, I wanted to tell you this, but the times that I thought about it weren't good times for you to hear about it, maybe during my divorce or something, or it was a not a good time for me to actually tell you. I didn't feel comfortable. But when you were 18 months old, you had a very high fever, and he said, I don't remember what illness you had, but you were ended up being hospitalized. And he said, while you were at home before the ambulance came and took you, mom was trying to keep your fever down, and she'd been dealing with this for hours and hours and hours. And he said that all of a sudden I stopped breathing and I went into convulsions. So my father called there was no 911. My father called the fire department, and they said they were sending an ambulance over, and they kept my father on the phone and gave instructions to submerge my little body in tepid bath water in the bathtub, have my mom do that, and that would then slowly lower my body temperature by adding ice cubes to the tepid water. So they said to her that if she added too many too fast, that it could cause me to go into shock because of the cold water. So my body could go into shock on top of what was happening to me, and that it wouldn't be good. So we only had one tray of ice cubes, my brother recounted. And so my mom sent my two brothers, one was 10 years older, one was 8 years older than me, off to the neighbor's houses to get ice. And when my oldest brother came back, he came back first, he handed the ice to my mom, and he said, he looked at me in the bathtub and he said, Barbie, you were soft purple, completely lifeless. And mom was sobbing over the top of you. And she took the ice and started adding it to the water. And we heard the ambulance pull up in front. And then my other brother ran in, and they were both standing in the doorway. And he said, as we were watching, you took a breath and arched your back backwards. And he said, you started crying and you came back to life. And he said, the ambulance people came in and pushed them out of the way and wrapped me up and took me off in the ambulance. And I was in the hospital for 4 days. And my parents chose never to talk about it. They told my two older brothers and my older sister, who at the time was only 6 years old. So one brother was 10 and one brother was 12. And then my sister was 6. And they told them that they didn't want to talk about it, that they were not to bring it up. And so it basically got forgotten. And everybody let it go. So that was a very life-changing story for me to find that out, that that had happened, because the things that had happened in my childhood had always been very hard for me to reconcile in my life. And I didn't know why I was different than my siblings. And I never knew why I had like the gifts that I had, and I kept them quiet, and I didn't want anyone to know.
I've got.
Uh-oh, someone needs to mute. And so what ended up happening was that in these two NDEs, I believe it kind of opened up a channel for me with the other side. And I've had incredibly interesting events that have occurred throughout my entire life. So people call it intuition. And it's also called precognition and manifestation. And it happens so many times that I don't actually recall every one of them. But some of the major ones that occurred were, I'll just go through my list here. When I was very young, maybe 3 and 4 years old, the phone would ring, you know, those old dial telephones. And I would call out, Mom, Grandma's calling, or Mom, Betty's calling, our neighbor, or Mom, you know, Dad is calling. And my mom would look at me and be very, you know, like, what are you doing? And then she'd pick up the phone, and invariably it would be the person I had said. So she was weirded out by that. And she actually told me to stop doing that. Don't tell me who's on the phone. It was kind of scaring her, I think. And at age 5, I was in Salem with my mom and my little sister, Jan. She was 3 years old. And we were standing on a street corner, and my mom was holding both of our hands. And what ended up happening was that I broke my mom's grip, which usually should not happen with my mom because, you know, you're 5 years old. You don't let your hand go out of her hand when you're out on the, you know, street corner. And she was perturbed that I had taken my hand out of her hand and I had put it over my face, covering my face. And she looked down at me and I was kind of peeking through my fingers. And she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "They're going to crash." And right after I said that, a car went sailing down the street through the intersection and hit another car broadside on the side of it. And there was this big, you know, spin around of the car and the crash and the noise. And, you know, and my mom let go of my little sister's hand, grabbed both of my shoulders and shook me and said, "How did you know that was going to happen? How did you know?" And so that for me was really scary at 5 years old. And I thought it was bad that I had known. And I started crying. So there were many things like that that occurred that I had to learn not to speak up. I had to learn not to let them know that I knew what was going to happen next. And I learned to curb it. Moving forward in my life, I was 16 years old and I was with my mom at a brand new mall that had opened up in Salem. And they were having a giveaway for a car and they had a huge drum that had like chicken wire and it was made out of wood and it was up on a table and there were all these pads of entry blanks. And you had to be a licensed driver to enter to win the car. So as my mom and I were walking through there and I saw that and I just, you know, my gosh, I got with the car. And I wasn't allowed to drive till I was 18. That was a rule in our family that the kids didn't get, my older brothers got to do it, but by the time they got to the three girls that were the youngest, we didn't get to drive till we were 18. So I said to my mom, "Can I have your driver's license? Let me enter that contest for you." And she said, "Oh, Barbie, you couldn't win a dirty sock." And she kept on walking. So I reached into her purse. I said, "Mom, it'll only take me a minute. I'll catch up to you. I'll meet you in there." And she was going to a particular store. And I said, I'll be right back. So I ran back to the table and I filled out one entry with my mom's name on it. And I think you had to put down driver's license or something. I'm not sure. And anyway, then about 2 weeks later or whatever, she got a phone call and out of 60,000 entries for that car, she won. I was the one who'd put the entry in. So actually I won, but because it was in her name, she gave it to my older brother. So I always say to my brother, "You owe me a car. Don't forget." He's mid 70s now. I don't think I'm going to be getting it from him. But anyway, then it was interesting that all through my childhood and teen years and everything that I won contests all the time. So if there was a radio contest where they said caller number 10, I would get it. There were often drawings and for things and I would win. And it was really weird kind of because I would just intently think, "Oh, I really want that." And I would win. So the same happened when I went to Las Vegas or Reno, slot machines. I would always win and it was really pretty shocking. I don't go all the time. It's not my place. That's not a place I like going to, but the few times that I did go, I had very great luck. So at age 17, I was in Salem and another incident happened. I was riding my bike across the bridge from West Salem where we lived over to the downtown area. And I had a job. I worked for the newspaper at that time. And I was riding along on my 10-speed bike, and all of a sudden, there was a feeling of a hand on the back of my head, pushing my head down over my handlebars of my bike. And I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know why I was getting pushed over the handlebars of my bike, and I fought it. And I tried, you know, strong, powerful, 5'9", 17-year-old. I'm trying to push back and stay upright because I don't want to look like one of those little kids that's riding on their bike like this. So the hand was much stronger than me, and I ended up getting my head, you know, I was bent over the front of my bike, and as I got very, you know, my face down over my handlebars, a big box truck was traveling in the same direction that I was going in, and the sidewalk was very thin on that bridge. There were two bridges, and the one that I was on had this very thin, really wasn't a walking sidewalk. The other bridge was better, but I was on my bike, and so anyway, the mirror on the side of the box truck stuck out quite a ways, and as it went past me doing, I don't know, 35 miles an hour, whatever, the mirror brushed over the back of my head, because my head was down over the handlebars, and it just literally touched my hair, and then I raised my head up, and I watched as the mirror on the truck, you know, proceeded towards the downtown area, and I realized in that moment that had I not had my head pushed down, if I had been sitting upright on my 10 speed, that truck mirror would have hit me in the middle of the back or the back of the head and probably knocked me off my bike into the lane of traffic and had a problem, big problem. So I stopped my bike on the bridge and I talked to what I call the other side. And that could be God or it could be whatever you think, angels, my deceased loved ones. I just talked to them and I actually started crying and I was looking out towards the river so the people driving by couldn't see me. And I was saying thank you. And I appreciate very much you intervening in that situation. And I know you saved my life. And I don't know who you are, but I'm so appreciative of this. And so that stuck with me. That was a really beautiful moment. Kind of an interesting moment that happened also in my 17th year was that, you know, it was in the 70s in 1974, it was kind of cool to go in my senior year to go to a kegger. So a friend of mine that did drink, I didn't drink, she invited me to go with her and another girlfriend too. And the three of us went to this kegger. It was way out in the country west of Salem. And it was down this long driveway to this home. And the kegger was happening on the, you know, cement driveway. The parents weren't home for the person that lived there. And they had like, you know, 100 people there. So there was loud music and it was fun. You know, even though I didn't drink, it was fun to just be there and talk to people. And so I was having a great time. And all of a sudden, I blinked my eyes really fast and I don't know why it happened, but just literally just, you know, blinked my eyes. And in the blinking, I saw that the police, because my mom was a police person, they were doing what's called a silent approach. And that meant that their lights were on and it was reflecting, I could see it was reflecting off of the trees that were kind of forming an arch over the roadway that went up to the house. And all the cars for all the people that were attending the party were parked on both sides of this roadway, this driveway. And I could see the police cars coming. And I knew that the girls that I were with, I was going to end up driving, you know, the girls' car home to get them home safely. And I knew that they had been drinking and that they were underage and they were going to get into a lot of trouble. So I grabbed them and said, come on. And I pulled them into the underbrush. And I said, the cops are coming, the cops are coming. And so we got back into the underbrush and right then, woo! And they all converged on this driveway with all these 100 people. And of course, people ran in all directions and they, you know, 2 hours later, they had caught whoever they had caught and they had a paddy wagon there. And the party had been broken up by the police. We were out in the bushes for the whole 2 hours. And as we were walking back to her car, they'd sobered up quite a bit. And one of the girls said, hey, wait a minute. How did you know that the cops were coming? Your mom is a cop. Are you a narc? Did you tell them that it was here? And I said, well, wait a minute. I didn't know it was here. She did. She never told me where it was. I didn't know where we were going tonight. And I didn't go in the house at all. And I, you know, we didn't have cell phones back then. So how would I have told them, you know, telepathy. And so the girl, I said, I happened to mention, well, I don't know what happened, but I said, I blinked my eyes really fast and I saw them coming. And so that girl started calling me a witch that evening and then at school the following Monday. And so some of the people around the school heard the incident and, you know, started calling me a witch, which really bothered me. And I got, you know, angry about that and told the girl that was talking about it to stop talking about it. And it ended up that it blew over. But I lost that friend in the meantime because she wouldn't stop doing what she was doing. And I didn't know how to explain it either, but I didn't like what was going on. The next thing that happened in my life was knowing that my daughter, who was born before my near-death experience, I knew she was coming. I was looking in a book. I was a photographer, and I was looking in a book of children's photography, photography of children, and I came upon a page that had a little redheaded girl, and she had brown eyes, and she was in a little pasture of daisies, and she had her, you know, her hands like this, and it was a really sweet picture. And there was something that inside me, I knew there was a daughter coming to me, and that she had red hair and brown eyes, and I knew that she was headed my way, and I felt very connected to her. So that was one of the things that proved true on her birth day of her birth, you know, red hair and brown eyes. And she's now 33 years old. So she's my little sweetie. And after I had my near-death experience, I, you know, had this problem with my husband still, you know, being abusive, etc. And I was afraid of him, and I ended up getting away from him, and I needed to find an apartment to move to. And when I was out searching for the apartment that I needed, I went to four different places that I explained that I was leaving a situation that was traumatic, and that I had my two children, and that I needed, you know, a safe place to be. And I had saved up because my husband controlled all of the money, including my salary, and just gave me a stipend each month. I had only been able to save up enough to pay for the first month's rent. And so I talked with the landlords for the four places and said, I can pay you your first month's rent, but I need to be able to pay the security deposit in increments over the next 6 or 8 months. If you could let me do that, I would so appreciate it. And the first four people said no. So it was at the end of the day, and I needed to go pick up my daughter from preschool. She was at that time, she was 3 years old. And so it had taken me about 2.5 years to get away from him. And he was going away on a business trip, and that's where the opening was, where I felt safe enough that he was going to be gone for a week, and that I probably couldn't get beaten up, and I probably couldn't get hurt, and neither could the kids if he was gone out of country. So the fifth person that I interviewed for an apartment, when I told him all the same information, he looked at me for a long time, and then he said, yes, you can move in. And I was just astonished, and I started crying, and I said, thank you so much. And I can't believe, thank you. You're believing in me, and I'm so thankful for that. Thank you. And he said, well, let me tell you, I grew up in the Netherlands. And he said, people that were running from the Nazis came to my door during World War II. And my parents would help in any way they could, whether it was an extra coat or an extra blanket or food. My parents always helped. And he said, today, when I saw your face when you were explaining what you were going through, he said, it took me back to the days when I was young and I saw those people and their faces. And it reminded me so much of them. And he said, today, I'm going to let you move into this apartment in honor of my parents. So I was on the stairs filling out the application to move in, and this elderly man came in from upstairs, and he was coming down the stairs, and he said to me, are you going to move in? And I said, he had an accent, and I said, yes, I am. And he said, gut. And so then it turned out that he and his wife were alone, never had children, And they, over the course of months living there, loved my two children, and they adopted me and my children and gave us the loving parental guidance that we totally cherished with having them right in the same building with us. And so, you know, it was kind of like I was guided to that fifth apartment. The first four probably wouldn't have been good apartments for me to find the loving location that I found. And that location ended up connecting me with my husband that I'm married to now, because during the 2 years that I was there, as my children had, you know, after they'd gone to bed and I'd done the homework and, you know, gotten the dishes done, and I would lay down in my room, and I started up a list of things that I thought would be good character traits, and specific things that I would want in someone if I was going to allow anyone into my life again, because I had, you know, been through what I'd been through. I wasn't very trusting of the opposite sex, and I didn't want to date, and I didn't want to take time away from my children to do that. And so I was writing a list, and I was saying every night to God, I was saying, you know, these are the types of things that I want in the person that I want to have in my life. And so if you could find him for me, and in the right timing for him and for me, bring us together in a safe, easy way so that I don't have to search for him. I don't have to date people. I'll just know right away that it's him. Then I would so appreciate it. And thank you so much. And then I would go to sleep. So it took me 2 years. I had 206 things on my list. Some of them were kind of funny because, you know, after cooking all meals and making lunches and everything for the kids all the way through from their birth, I was always responsible for all of the cooking. I put down on the list one night, has to like TV dinners because I'm so tired of cooking. So the other funny one was, it said, I remembered a person I had dated that was shorter than me because I'm 5'9", I'm pretty tall. And the person at a dance in college had laid his head on my shoulder, and we were dancing, slow dancing, and I felt like, oh, this is so uncomfortable. And so I wrote down, must be tall. And this one Saturday, I was in my apartment and my son was out riding his bike in the neighborhood. He was 13 by this time, and my daughter was 5. And so I was in my apartment, and my son came in with a girl that he had met in the neighborhood, and they wanted to go to a movie. And they asked me if I would take them, and I said, okay. And then they said for me to meet them over at her house, which was right around the corner, literally half a block away. And so I did. And I changed out of my clothes and got into something I would want to go to the movie in, and knocked on the front door. And there, lo and behold, was a 7-foot-tall guy who is now my husband. And the children had asked him to go to the movie as well as me, and they were putting us together. So it was the safe way to meet. And I was very embarrassed that my son did that, but it turned out wonderfully. And 6 months later, we were married, and it's now been 27 years. So I'm married to an ex-NBA basketball player who played for Golden State Warriors. And he's a gentle, kind, loving person that I had all of those aspects on my list. And he doesn't like TV dinners, but he does love to cook. So instead of TV dinners, we have Victor-made meals. And so that's very much fun. So after we married, we got pregnant as a surprise because he had had a vasectomy just before our marriage, because we decided with his two children, he had a boy and a girl, and my two children, my boy and girl, that was enough for both of us. And so he went and got a vasectomy. And soon after the marriage, I found out I was pregnant. So about the 6th month of the pregnancy, I was in the freezer getting an ice pack out because my husband had the flu. And I don't know what happened, but I, right here, just in the lower part of my neck area here, felt this absolute knowledge. And I had had that happen before, where it was just this absolute knowledge of something that was going to happen. And it felt it like right here, just kind of hit me right here. I don't know if that's a, you know, a certain chakra or something, but I would just know something. And I knew immediately that I was going to have an 11-pound baby. So my first one had been 7.5. My second one was 8.5. 11 is huge. So I talked with my husband, and he said, well, talk to, you know, your doctor and see what he says. So I did on two different occasions, and he dismissed it and said, no, it's not even possible. Forget it. And on the third occasion, I decided to tell him about my near-death experience. And I said, you know, I have had intuition since I was very young, and I've had, you know, a near-death experience, and I need you to listen to me. And he said, if you want to continue talking about this, you can find yourself another doctor. I'm not doing another ultrasound. We already did one in the third month. You're not having an 11-pound baby. So the day of the birth came, and yes, that baby was 10 pounds, 13 ounces, 3 ounces short of 11 pounds. He was a week early. And because the doctor did not do a C-section and had me start to deliver it, you know, naturally, the baby couldn't get out of the birth canal. And the size of his head and the size of his body was too big for the birth canal. Should not have been started that way. So the baby's life was very threatened on the day of his birth. He did survive. He is my 26-year-old son, Tori, and he's perfectly fine. But I, in the midst of the delivery, when the doctor panicked and said that he was going to have to break the baby's shoulders to get him out, I sent up the biggest prayer and said, please God, you know, I have told him what you told me, that he was going to be big. He wouldn't listen to me. Please don't make the baby be injured, and please help me and the baby through this situation. And I don't believe that to this day that it was the doctor's capacity that got that baby out of me. I believe it was help from above. So one of the other last stories is kind of an interesting one. Well, actually there's two. When I was in Belize, I was on a cruise ship with my employees from my store here in Santa Barbara. I had a store, a paper art store, and we were on a cruise, and I got off the cruise ship in the morning, and my employees, there were three of them, they decided they wanted to go lay on the beach. And because I'm a redhead, I will sunburn very quickly. So I said, no, I'll just walk with everybody else from the cruise ship into Belize City, and I'll do some shopping for getting things that are cool for my kids. So as I was walking along this sidewalk with hundreds of other tourists coming, flooding from the cruise ship area where it's a secure area, there were about 14 people standing along the side of the sidewalk, and it looked like they were just relaxing and leaning against the wall and talking to each other as 14 black guys. And I don't have any problems with any color of anybody. I'm not scared of people. I love people, and it doesn't bother me at all. Nothing, no color, no religion, no nothing. I accept everybody. So what was interesting was that I was walking alone, and then there were four people in front of me and a group of four people behind me. And this one of the guys just reached out, and he took a hold of my left arm. He grabbed my left arm and he pulled me sideways, and there was an alleyway. And two of the guys that were with him kind of closed ranks over the front of the alleyway and blocked it off so that nobody even knew that I was missing and didn't even know that I was gone. And so he was dragging me down the alleyway by my arm and saying, you know, you're just not going to believe what I'm going to show you. And I knew that it wasn't something where he was just going to show me something. I knew I was going to be robbed, raped, murdered. I had no idea what, but it was going to be bad, because you don't just grab somebody off a sidewalk. And so in that walkway, in that little alleyway, I actually heard my mom's voice, and she had, you know, an anger to her voice in that moment. And she's used to, when I was young and my little sister and I, she used to say to us, if anyone ever uses the element of surprise against you, I want you to remember to use the element of surprise against them to get away. So if they abduct you, use the element of surprise against them. So I remembered that because my mom said in that alleyway, I heard her voice very clearly say, use the element of surprise. And in that moment, then I calmed down and I took another couple steps and I actually used to throw shot put. So my right arm's very strong and I just plowed my fist right into his nose, which made him let go of my left arm. I turned and started running towards the front of the alleyway, but those two guys' backs were towards me. They were blocking it. And I just used the kind of punch like football players do. And I just used my arms and I pushed them down and I ran through between the two of them. And I ran straight back to the security gate for the cruise ship area, started crying my head off. And I was told at the time that they're a gang, that they pay off the police and that they do this often. And it's a robbery and usually a rape situation. So I got away very safely. I was very proud of myself, but yeah, it was very scary. I didn't want to do anything else in Belize, that's for sure. And for the rest of the cruise, I was made sure my employees stayed with me. But I think one of the biggest stories was in 2016, I was talking at four of the IANS groups up in San Francisco. And I was driving back with my husband to Santa Barbara. He was driving our van. Toyota van, and we were just north of Santa Barbara at Gaviota, where they had the big oil spill in the 1960s, I think, that caused Earth Day to be created. And so we were coming from inland, and the roadway goes from inland and hits the ocean, and then it curves south and it starts heading towards Santa Barbara. Sorry, my leg needed to be stretched out. So what ended up happening was that after we turned around the corner, there was a big gust of wind that hit the side of our van, and my husband was struggling to keep the van under control. And so I was watching that because I was laying backwards in my seat. I was laying down with my feet up on the dashboard and just relaxing. We'd had a long drive from San Francisco, 5 hours or so. And so I was ready to just get home. And when I watched him, struggling with the wheel, I calmly said, Victor, I think maybe with this kind of wind gusts, we should maybe slow down. Maybe we shouldn't be doing 65. Let's go down to 50. I think that might be safer. And so he said, yeah, I think you're right. And so he slowed down to 50. And what ended up happening then was I was just laying there on my seat, thinking we were safe and okay. And this little voice in like the side of my head by my ear whispered and said, danger, big impact ahead, danger, big impact. And I didn't know, who it was, or I didn't say like, who are you? And I didn't know what they were talking about. And so I sat up in my seat, checked my seatbelt, put my feet on the floor and checked it, make sure my seatbelt was nice and tight on me. And then I turned to Victor and said, Victor, I think that something dangerous is up ahead. I just, how I often hear from the other side, I said, I just heard, danger, big impact ahead, danger, big impact. And I said, so something dangerous is up ahead. I don't know what. It could be, a deer. It could be a car. I mean, I don't know what it is, but we need to slow down further. Instead of doing 50 miles an hour, can we do 30? And he looked at me and he went, Barbara, we're on the freeway. And I said, yeah, uh-huh. And I turned and looked through the back of our van and I said, there's nobody back there behind us. So nobody's, can't see any lights, headlights back there. It was about 9:30 at night. And so I said, why don't you do 30 miles an hour and watch the rearview mirror. And if you see someone coming, then you can go ahead and speed up to 50 if that's what you feel comfortable with. But, we need to be able to stop fast because something up ahead is dangerous. So why don't we do that? Okay. And would that make you feel comfortable? And he said, yes. And so I said, okay, great. So we're driving along for like maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and we come around a corner. We're still doing 30 miles an hour. Nobody's caught up to us. I don't know why. You know, this is a busy highway going from Lompoc and Buellton, California, to down to Santa Barbara along the coastline. It's the only highway you can take to get there from the north. So we're, you know, cruising along and everything seems okay, and the wind's still buffeting the car, but we're only doing 30 miles an hour and feeling okay. Come around a corner, and way up ahead in the dark, we see a police car's lights. And I felt again right here that that's where the danger was. So I then, you know, I was sitting upright, and I, as we approached the police car's, you know, lights in the dark, I was watching very intently, you know, why is the police car there? And the first thing I noticed was that the police car wasn't parked off of the highway, you know, on the median strip on the side. He was parked in the slow lane, blocking it completely with his car. And then as we got closer, I could see that there wasn't a police officer within the range of his lights, his headlights, and his lights above his car. There was nobody there. I couldn't see anybody. And so I was, what, you know, why would this empty police car be parked in the lane out here in the middle of nowhere? Because there's no street lights or anything up there. It's really kind of vacant, and there's nothing up there. And so we were coming closer and closer. We're in the slow lane where the police car is blocking. And as my husband started to change lanes to go around the police car, 50 yards behind the police car, all of a sudden, whoever it was on the other side grabbed both of my upper arms. I felt them just grab my upper arms, and then they put their face like directly in front of my face, and they screamed 10 miles an hour. And I was so shocked that they touched me and that I felt their face. I almost kind of almost saw it, but I, you know, it's not like I know who these people are that are warning me. So I don't know who it was. But I then echoed and said 10 miles an hour to Victor. And he slowed down from 30 to 10, so that right as we got level with the police car, we were 10 miles an hour. And just after we rolled past the police car in the fast lane, our lights finally lit up what was way in front of the police car. He'd stopped his car way back from it. He'd gotten out, knowing that the California Highway Patrol had a police blockade behind us. That's why no cars were catching up to us. And so he had gotten out of his car and climbed up on the semi truck that had tipped over, and he was standing up on top of it talking to the truck driver. But because the howling winds and the ocean were making so much noise, he didn't even know we were coming. So we were heading straight for the bottom of the cab of the truck, which is where the gas tanks are. And because we were only doing 10 miles an hour, we were able to go off the side of the road over into gravel on the left-hand side and go around the truck in a really safe manner. And on the far side, I looked up, and that's when I saw the policeman up there talking to the truck driver. He had his back to where we had come from. He was looking south towards Santa Barbara. So I immediately began thanking the other side for that warning. And I thank them for Victor's life, for my life, for the police, you know, man's life, and the truck driver's life. And I was, you know, 10 minutes, I was just saying thank you for saving all of us from that situation. You know, I wouldn't have wanted to blow up the truck by hitting the gas tanks. Anything that would have happened to us and them, I thank you so much for protecting all of us. And about 10 minutes later, as I was still thanking, Victor turned to me, he was quiet, and he said, "Barbara, how is it that you're able to do that? If I had not just watched that unfold, if I had not been here and you told me this happened, even having been married to you this long," he said, "I'm not sure I would have been able to believe it." He said, "I would have had to see that unfold to just, how do you do this?" And I said, "You know, Victor," and it's the main point of my story tonight, all my stories, "it is not me who does it. It's not intuition. It's actually the help from the other side, that if you're open to it And I guess, you know, a big part of that is asking for it and also being thankful for it. These types of things can happen to anyone. It's not something special. I do kind of think that maybe the NDEs opened me up to understanding that the other side was there and having a little clearer connection or something. But I think, you know, intuition happens with a lot of people who haven't had near-death experiences. And I don't think it's a personal, what it says online about intuition is gut instinct or intuition is your immediate understanding of something. You just know trusting your intuition is the ultimate act of trusting yourself. But I kind of have a different view on that. It's not something coming from me. It's something coming from outside of me, and I feel it as an NDEer. I feel them there, and I trust them, and I have never had anything negative happen ever. They've always been helpful. I don't know who they are. I never stop and say, you know, are you an angel? Are you, you know, I didn't even in my NDE say, are you God? I didn't question anything. But I believe that our intuition, our precognition, manifestation, it's actually just assistance coming to us from the other side. I don't know, you know, who it is, but I'm always grateful. And I spend time telling them how thankful and appreciative I am for their assistance. I believe that we all of us have somebody watching over us. And you can call it whatever you want. But usually more than one person, perhaps. And inviting their help and telling them that you're thankful for their interactions in your life opens you up to even more assistance. This isn't to imply that they're always helping me in every instance, because I believe that we're all here on this earth to live out our lives and learn lessons along the way. But there are definitely times when they know that a little guidance, intervention, and assistance are definitely needed. And so talk to them. Tell them you're open to their assistance and be sure to say thank you when you feel their loving touch in your life. So that's the end of my story today about the double dead redhead having an amazing life. And I'm open to any questions that you have. I'd love to hear your questions. So okay. Please unmute yourself.
Well, no, I'd prefer to have happen is there's a chat window. And okay. if people have some questions, if we just had everybody unmute, it would be chaos. Oh. You would, sorry, if you don't guys. Know what chaos is, have everyone on mute.
Okay. So you read the question and I'll answer it. How's that?
Yeah. Okay. That's one way of doing it. I mean, you can open up your own chat window and read them, but one question.
I think it'd probably be you can just pose them to me. That'll be great.
Okay. So the Gary Henderson says, Gailey Henderson, excuse me. If she has time for questions, please ask if she has any insights about COVID-19 and what's going to happen to our country and how can our prayers be more effective?
Yeah, I think our prayers are effective and I think they are working. I don't know why this is here at this time. I wish that I knew. I think that, you know, it's been so traumatic for some people and it's been the exact opposite for others. Staying home, doing projects, staying away from the world, inner focusing, expanding yourself, etc., having time to do that, whereas, you know, some of our busy lives don't usually give us that to do. I'm not exactly sure why all of this is happening right now. I have had previous intuitions over things that were going to happen. And my feeling right now has started probably 4 or 5 years ago. And I, you might call me a prepper, but I started feeling as though I needed to put food away for Victor and I and possibly the tenants that live in our main house. And so I've been, tomorrow, in fact, I'm getting an upright freezer delivered. And I've got, you know, storage of food that I'm kind of preparing for something in case it happens. If it doesn't happen and we don't eat the food, I give it away to the homeless shelter. So for me, it doesn't bother me to get extra food and know that it's going to go and be used by someone if it's not used by myself or my 30-somethings tenants that are, I have six tenants altogether that live in our main house, and we live in our cottage. This is the cottage of our main house. So, you know, it doesn't bother me to be able to give that food away in case I need to do that. So I would say that it's been for quite a while feeling in my heart that something's coming, and I don't know if the COVID-19 is it, or if something bigger even is going to be happening down the line. And I don't know what it might be, but I would just say, you know, plan ahead and take care of yourself and others that you love, and do your best in this situation with reaching out and helping and loving others. This is what we all need to do during something like this. So that's it.
Okay, next question. From someone that doesn't have their name on it. It's Nexus830. Is there a book?
I don't have a book. I've been told by hundreds of people that every time I do the talk in Chicago or Salt Lake City, because I was there with you guys before, or Vancouver, British Columbia, or Portland or Seattle, everybody always says, do a book. But I know it's coming. It just hasn't. And I know that during this COVID-19 thing, I might actually start it. I had a couple of other projects I needed to do first, but it may be coming out. And I think I'll probably name it The Amazing Life of a Double Dead Redhead. So you'll recognize it when it comes out. So it's just getting it done.
Okay, this one's from Gary. Sorry, but I came in late. Did you have an experience between lives and see some of your previous lives?
No, but one of the people that's on my board of directors here in Santa Barbara is a past life regression therapist. And when I first started IANS, he and a local general practitioner doctor and a marriage family therapist all came forward when a big article about my near-death experience appeared in the local newspaper in 2011. And they all came forward and said they wanted to help me with this, organizing this IANS group. So this past life regression therapist, I would let all of these people, there were five of them, in the front of the meeting, I would say, you know, hey, these are my five supporters that are my board of directors. And so I would let each one of them give, you know, a minute worth of this is what I do, so that people in the audience would know who they were. And the past life regression therapist would always, you know, say that he did life between lives and everything. And I never knew what he was talking about. I had never heard of past life regression therapy, and I had no idea. So about 3 months into having the meetings, he called me and he said, Barbara, I can tell that you don't understand what it is I do. Would you like to experience it? And I terribly wanted to say, no, I don't. I don't even know what that is, but I don't want to find out. But I said yes. And so I went ahead and went over to his house, and he hypnotized me, and I saw one of my past lives. And it was absolutely something that, besides my near-death experience, is one of the biggest things of my life. I saw why I have this acceptance of all people, and why I have maybe a love of people. I, as a child, always walked up to the child that was coming into our school, knew that was colored in some way. Maybe they were black, or they were Hispanic, or they were Indian, or they were, you know, who knows what, from any country, wherever. I was absolutely thrilled with them being there, because I had this little Salem, Oregon, you know, white bunch of kids that were around my neighborhood. And I immediately walked up to them and said, hi, my name is Barbara, and I want to be your friend. So I would adopt them immediately, and we would become friends over and over all through the years. And so it was, you know, very interesting to see that in my past life, I was a black child in Africa and slave traders came storming into the village that I was in. I got separated from my parents. They ended up finding me hiding in some bushes, and they did take me, and I was placed on a plantation purchased by the plantation owners to help. I was probably about 8 or 9 years old, and I was purchased to help the woman who was the cook to peel potatoes and do all of the junky stuff for fixing all the food for the white people that were the family that owned the plantation, as well as all the black workers. So I watched that life actually move from that 8 or 9 years old all the way up to about 16 years old. And then I didn't, you know, he closed the door on that life, but it was the most amazing experience to see that and feel myself in a different colored skin, and to know that I had that in my past. And I somehow felt that in my early childhood and always wanted to be accepting of everyone. So I haven't, you know, myself, I haven't ever experienced anything beyond what he showed me, but I know that we have multiple lives, and I really honestly feel that we're here multiple times with perhaps the same group of people learning, you know, both sides of each coin. So one time you're abusive and the next time you're being abused or something else, just to grow our souls so that we can understand both sides of things and have a larger, more beautiful grasp on what it's like to be in a human state. So that's it.
So Barbara, there aren't any more questions, but there's one comment. Okay. So thank you for sharing your lovely story. Thank you so much for the reminder to be open to these intuitions. Yep. So I think your story is one of the better ones for illustrating that NDEs aren't just a fiction of a dying brain or something, because, you know, you were able to recount all those incidents that happened while you were physically dead.
Yeah. So, it was a beautiful gift. You know, the big thing about it is that I didn't know it existed. And yet after I assimilated it and I felt comfortable enough to actually, it was always very clear all through the years that I didn't talk about it in my heart, but I didn't speak about it to anybody else. And I kind of kept it in a little box. Once I took it out and I started, you know, looking at it and allowing it to be part of me, it was such an incredibly beautiful gift, and I wouldn't pass this life up for anything. I absolutely love having that NDE be part of me and what it gave me and what it allowed me to see in the way that the world works and how others need to be loved. And I can't imagine. I wish I could give it to everybody, and that's why I should write the book, but you know, I will, I promise. So thank you so much, everybody, for listening. I appreciate it so much.
Well, anyhow,
if you want to contact me, I'll give you my email address. So it's Sunny like sunshine. So it's Sunny and then SB standing for Santa Barbara. So Sunny SB and then my name, Barbara. So there are two B's in a row, sunnysbbarbara@gmail.com. And then my telephone number, if you want to call me at any time and talk, is 805-451-8646. And I'm retired. And other than talking about my NDEs and doing fun things with my husband and his life and our kids, I'm available. So please feel free to give me a call, especially if you come to Santa Barbara. I'd love to meet up with anybody who comes. Thanks, everybody.
Okay. Well, you have one more question.
Okay.
Which speakers are you looking forward to hearing at the conference?
No. Oh, I love, let's see. I'm pretty sure Anita Morjani is going to be talking. And also, I love Mary Neal and Jeff Olson and Jeff O'Driscoll, who were just here at my IANS group in February. I love those two guys. And then, you know, there's so many, every time I get to the conferences, I go every year. It's going to be hard this year because it's all, you know, online, but it's just like family. I never want to leave. I just, you know, I want to have them all come and live in Santa Barbara, like have a little, you know, I don't know, I don't know, they can all live in my front house. But I just really wish that, you know, I could be there with them. But we're going to do it online this year. And then in 2022, we're going to be in Salt Lake City. Yay. Mm. And I saw that somebody wanted my telephone number repeated. So my number is 805-451-8646. And that's my cell phone. So feel free to call me if you'd like to.
And we can post it on the website too. So
yeah, you're welcome to do that. Sure. I have a lot of people who call because there's a documentary that Anthony Cheen did on YouTube. It's called The Near-Death Experience of Barbara Bartolome. And I think it's got around 658,000 views in 3 years. And people contact me because of that and situations that they want to talk about something in their own life. And I'm happy to talk with people. I brief it with saying, you know, I'm not a marriage family therapist. I don't have training in counseling. I'm giving you information from my heart and you can take it or leave it and whatever resonates for you. So I can't fix people's lives, but I definitely want to try to help in some way. So there you go.
Thanks so much. We enjoyed hearing you.
Yeah. I love you guys in Salt Lake City. I wish I was there with you. So yeah. Hugs to you all.
Okay. Thank you very much, Barbara.
Thanks again. Bye-bye, everybody.